It's time for an episode of the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll. I'm Ray Koob.
I'm Marcus Goldman.
And this episode of Game Changers marks the beginning of our sixth year as a podcast. Is that possible?
It is. We got here.
Well, happy birthday, dude.
Happy podcast birthday.
5 years of the Imbalanced History, and some of you at least haven't gotten sick of us yet. So thank you for that. In the last couple of years, we've kind of developed this idea of game changers, albums, events, persons, places, things that have changed the course of rock and roll. And what have we on the menu for this edition of Game Changers, Marcus?
This edition of Game Changers came out in the year 1978, an album that completely shook the fucking world big time. As a 12-year-old, it shook my world. It shook all my friends' worlds. It shook all their older brothers and sisters' worlds. It shook everybody's worlds. And it was a fun fucking record that just got smacked upon us.
It's funny because you were at the beginning of your teens and I was at the very end of mine. And still a rocker at heart, listening to all kinds of music, all the punk and all the new wave stuff. And in the middle of it, this record comes out. It makes me go full stop and turn my head and go, what? It really did. Because you weren't expecting this kind of a game changer of a rock album in early 1978. Really, you weren't if you were around and fully up to speed with what was going on in music.
Yep. And as an early teen, putting my head around the fact that that was one dude crushing it on guitar and not like three or four guitar players was pretty mind-blowing at the time, because what this kid did, a teen himself, was absolutely revolutionary. This band changed the course of rock and roll history without a doubt. This album, without a doubt, changed everybody's world in some way when it came out.
We're talking about the self-titled debut album from Van Halen.
Ugh.
Obviously, there's two Van Halens, but as Dave once said, we all got a little Van Halen in us.
And he ain't lying. What they did with these songs, some of them really dark fucking tunes too, but they made you feel good. And not only the guitar, but the rhythm section together, and then Dave's super fun vocal style really made you move to the groove, and you danced, and they sang these anthemic songs when they were live, and the crowd would sing them back and sing along with them, and it was just madness when they would play live in those early days when they blew up.
Before they hooked up with Ted Templeman and everybody at the Bunny Hutch to make this debut album, they were out there slinging it. And this demo that I found and listened to extensively called Zero is kind of like a roadmap to how they're going to get to be Van Halen. The feels are there, the songs are there, the riffs are there. Even some of the rough versions of the songs that would be on the first album are there. I found it on YouTube. It's Van Halen Zero. Really, to me, made more sense out of what we got on the debut album because they were almost there.
That band worked their asses off. They were practicing all the time. They were playing live all the time. The first time Ted Templeman saw them live in Pasadena, he said they were playing to a small crowd, but they played as if they were in a sold-out arena, something that U2 also did a few years later. This band had the chops. They had the feel. And when Ted Templeman saw him on that night, he was so blown away by who Eddie Van Halen was and how he was playing in such a revolutionary style as a teenager and not flaunting it, not showing it off, just fucking doing it. And the way he did it really blew Ted Templeman away.
Once they decided who was really going to play what, right? Alex switched to drums, Eddie switched to guitar, and the rest is rock and roll history. But once they made that move and they found Dave, Mark Stone had left and they brought in Mike, this was the core that was going to make rock and roll history. And as we've been talking about, change the game that was. The end results, a diamond debut, 10 million sold in the U.S., 4 times platinum in Canada, and it even sold 100,000 copies in their native Netherlands, which is a lot. It's a platinum record in Netherlands, so they don't have as many people as we have here.
That album went platinum by October after its release in March. It hit people so fucking hard. And again, I don't know what the over-under on the Peachy reference is, but in 78, this kid was drawing the Van Halen logo all over his Peachy folder.
As much as it was about the music, it was about that logo and all the different ways it could appear, right? That's what people started to discover on those Peachy folders, on their jackets. A lot of denim jackets had it written in pen, man. People were scribbling it everywhere, perfecting their version of that Van Halen logo.
That band's fans became obsessed with them right away. Right away.
On that debut album, their Kids in a Candy Store, Sunset Sound, they know the place. They grew up around there. It started out as a Disney movie sound recording facility. The music for movies like Mary Poppins or 101 Dalmatians was recorded in the same studio where they made the first Van Halen record. And we just mentioned that for point of reference. In addition to those movies and many more, over 200 albums made over the years in this amazing studio. Do you know one of the reasons they liked it, Marcus? It was an old garage on the Warner set, and they liked the way that the floor sloped so that it wouldn't trap the sound of the music they were making.
Ah, it gave it room to move instead of dying and falling. Oh, wow, I bet that would flatten the sound.
It attracted the likes of Elton John, Led Zeppelin, Prince for part of the Purple Rain sessions. Parts of Pet Sounds were recorded there. The LA sessions for Exile on Main Street and those first two amazing albums by The Doors, all recorded there at Sunset.
Man, LA's got some legendary studios. Holy shit.
And Ted knew his way around most of them. For this first album, all hail Uncle Ted Templeman. Whatever you say, Ted, we're doing it. They were smart that way. It took them 3 weeks, cost $40,000. That's nothing in the scheme of recording budgets.
Absolutely, and I'm sure they went through a lot of tape, and tape was expensive back then. Holy cow, $40,000, a great deal. And they recorded like 25, 26 songs in those 3 days, and they had had most of those songs crafted already because of the time that they had spent working on their songs, writing their songs, practicing their songs, and playing them live.
So when they hit record at Sunset, they were truly ready to go. And what a better way could they have come up with to start the sequence, Marcus, than the intro to Running with the Devil.
The sounds that open up that album just builds you up and makes you feel so good and kicks your ass.
Oh, God. Rock and roll history is full of people who like to talk about Dave Davies cutting the cone moment in the studio with the Kinks for You Really Got Me. It kind of spawned what Ed and all the other new generation of guitar players are all about, that wide open sound. And so he does what is essentially his homage to playing wide open on Eruption before dive bombing into You Really Got Me for the second track and another fucking killer radio tune.
Ray Davies had said that Van Halen's cover of You Really Got Me was his favorite cover of a Kinks song ever. Whereas, true to Kinks' form, his brother, Dave, said the exact opposite and said that he didn't like it. Basically, he didn't like their flashier approach, and his comment was something like, "Hey, man, look at me with my tight trousers." You know?
But, oh, man. At the time, that sounded like an old guy, right?
Yeah, boy, what a curmudgeon he was in the late 70s, early 80s already. But it's a great cover, and that song kicked ass, just like the rest of this album.
Yeah, every now and then you tip a hat to an influence. But they had songs, man. Next up on side one, Ain't Talking About Love. It really starts to show the swagger that Diamond Dave has up front. Baby! My love is rotten to the core.
Absolutely a dark ass song that makes you feel good while you're moving to it. How they were able to pull that off is really, really incredible. Originally, Eddie said, I think something like he didn't really dig this song very much. It was your basic two chord riff and nothing fancy and nothing that was Eddie Van Halen-ish. But Ted Templeman really loved it. The rest of the band really liked it. They put it together. And it is still a monster for them all over rock radio to this day.
Side one closes with I'm the One, a song that has been overlooked by some because it's not the most spectacular gymnastic high-flying act type song, but one of the great Van Halen songs to close side one.
And one that really, really gives you a feel for David Lee Roth's swagger as well. This song was about Dave, no doubt about it. I'm the One. Woo!
In some ways, it's always been all about Dave. Just ask him.
Yeah, but there are two front people in this band, and Eddie really was what the label people were drawn to at first. So they're a complete band.
I call him the Beethoven of our times because he innovated the way that Ludwig did in his idiom on the guitar. Truly an amazing icon of his day. And that's why this album and this first side of it really changed the game, man. It changed the game for everybody who was anywhere in the rock range. They kept bringing in new batches of kids every couple of years with new albums. In fact, the second album comes like a year later.
Yep, and the second album had the same kind of impact that that first album did. It hit hard, and it made them one of the bigger rock bands in the world pretty quickly. They rose rapidly, and I think at times that massive quick rise was very hard for them as well, especially Eddie and Alex, who are both more introverted in nature.
We'll talk more about that and get into side two as this episode of Game Changers about the self-titled debut album from Van Halen continues next
on the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll.
Sitting here at the backstage door at the Look It Up 10th anniversary celebration. Far back with people, too many men wearing kilts, even for Crooked Eye nights. There's always somebody in a kilt. And you hear the guys are getting themselves set up, the Crooked Eye band getting ready to take the stage in a few minutes. Here at Crooked Eye with Dennis from the Crooked Eye band. What's this place mean to you as a musician and as a guy?
Well, I've been searching my whole life for a place like this. I've played many places, near and far, large and small. And this is my absolute favorite place to play. There is something magical here. And you feel it. You've been here a number of times. It's this strange vibe between the people that have a high music quotient and a band that just wants to play. And for anybody that wants to listen, and the reciprocation that occurs between the two and the way that can...
It's a symbiosis, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful thing. Robert Fripp describes it very well as it lifts the craft off the ground. It puts the wind into the sail.
When we all started hanging out here, did you ever think we'd be doing 10 years?
I thought I'd be playing here until I couldn't play anymore.
The man who lays down the nasty beats. Mr. Jeff Moran on bass, Crooked Eye Band. 10 years we're marking tonight.
10 years.
First off, did you think we'd be here 10 years later?
No, this is so incredible that this has turned into A, such a great brewery, and B, such a great music venue that they allow us to come in here and play.
So what's Crooked Eye mean to you, man?
Family. It's definitely a family atmosphere. And the families that own it and the families that come here and the people that hang here are just... They're like brothers and sisters and mothers and dads and everything. Unbelievable. I remember walking up, I ordered a brown ale. The Top Hat brown ale was the first beer I had. It was pretty good. It was like they had, I think, four beers on tap. And it was this little wooden shelf that you had to come up there and it was crazy. I'm like, oh, and now it's what it is today. It's just unbelievable.
The master brewer, Jeff Mulhern, how you doing, man?
I'm doing well. This is kind of surreal. Can't believe it's been 10 years.
What's been the best part of this whole thing for you as a person and as a brewer?
Probably being my own boss, being able to be creative, and doing a job that I absolutely love.
That's Jeff. And here are the brothers-in-law, Paul and Paul, who, along with Jeff, you started in whose kitchen was it?
It was in Jeff's kitchen. We moved it into my garage.
Yeah, we've been doing it for a while. Then we decided to give this a shot.
Now, a lot of people have been posting the pictures of then and now of this space. We're standing in the brew room right now. Marcus and I talk about this all the time. But the pictures on your Facebook really show how far you've come from the plank bar at the beginning, at the front, just it's at the front here. Now the whole building is pretty much you guys, and it's a blossoming brewery and quite an affair at 10.
Thanks for the advertising you do for us. Helps a lot.
Yep. One hand washing the other. Thanks for your support.
Oh, that's guys. It. Thanks for your support through the years and many more to come.
Quite a party, guys. The Crooked Eye Band is taking the stage. But what do they mean to you?
Those guys are like family. They've been with us since almost the very beginning, and it just keeps growing and growing and growing.
Yeah, they're amazing musicians, and they're even better people.
Yes,
It's the Brewery Brain Trust, the Mulherrins, here with us at the 10th anniversary celebration of Crooked Eye. 10 years! 10 years!
1070! Happy birthday!
1070! We're back on this episode of Game Changers, talking about the debut album from Van Halen. The timing with this is, with so many things in rock and roll, is pretty much everything, Marcus. I mean, think about it. In February of 1978, we had just been through punk rock, the beginnings of new wave, if you will. Bands like Talking Heads and Elvis Costello and others that were starting to make an impact along with punk rock. The last thing people were really looking for or thinking that they wanted was a new hard rock band from California. But Gene Simmons somehow knew, right? He knew.
For as much as we can disparage Gene Simmons, he has a good eye for a lot of things in the music industry. And he is accurate, and he pisses people off because he says things that make people uncomfortable. And whether you agree or disagree with him, but he was spot on about Van Halen.
Yes, he was. And he got enough people's attention around to it that Mo Austin and Ted Templeman, who is one of the shining stars of producers at Warner Brothers Records, attended a gig at the legendary Starwood.
All my flavors, 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 all my flavors. I say all my flavors, guarantee.
The anniversary just passed, February 3rd, 1977. Seems like a long time ago. Saw them and signed them to a deal with Warner Brothers Records.
Yeah, they had played two nights in a row, and Ted Templeman saw them the first night, and then he called Mo, and he's like, dude, I'm telling you, you're clearing your calendar, and you're coming with me tonight. And they went to see him the second night. They were all just blown away by what Eddie was doing.
And the sound they were playing added an entire different facet to the Warner Brothers Records identity. Hey, buddy, you know, I saw this and I thought we should mention it, even though we're not always in real time around here on the imbalanced history of rock and roll. But brother Alex set to release his memoir. It's called Brothers, surprisingly, out October 22nd, 2024. It's the book you want.
We're going to have to read that, hopefully, before it comes out. I really want to read that book.
Publicist friends, hello, advance copies. We're digging into the debut from Van Halen on this episode of Game Changers on the Imbalanced History. Let's talk about the game-changing song that kicks off side two. Probably the most sampled part of the Van Halen catalog out there. I'm talking about that opening riff on Jamie's Crying. I was always amazed that he could make the guitar cry like that. You know what I'm talking about? That wah, wah, wah. Unbelievable.
Yeah, when he plays the guitar on that record, you feel every single note he plays, including the tears in Jamie's Crying.
For the angst of atomic punk. Kind of cool conceptually as well. And it's worth noting that all these songs were written by all four of them, no matter what anybody contributed. They all shared credit. Well, the studio must have been full of song and voice, too. They all sang a lot. And one of the best songs to use as an example on this album, Feel Your Love Tonight, right down to the killer cold ending.
Boy, this is some filthy, yummy, delicious kind of love indeed. What can you say? It's one of those that just gets those carnal feelings going, those lusts. It's just one of those songs that, you know.
Dave would say mission accomplished.
Yeah. It was also the song where Alex would showcase his drum solos in the earlier days as well.
Little Dreamer is kind of a different feeling song and really shows Dave's vocal variety, if you will, and a lot of soul.
Yeah, his smartness really comes through again on this song.
Let me talk about your cold when you were headed for the skies. But you were young and bold, and baby, didn't that change with a wink of your eye? Talking about those crazy days gone by. No one talks about the times you cried. A little dreamer.
Because of his clown behavior, I don't think people really give David Lee Roth enough credit for being as smart as he is. His double entendres are fantastic.
Yeah.
His imagery is fantastic in his songwriting. He definitely deserves the credit for being an excellent songwriter, because he is.
And one of the greatest frontmen in American rock and roll history.
Without a doubt.
Sometimes people are quick to rush to include so many different bands in the discussion of greatest American rock and roll bands. They're a little slow on the Van Halen uptake, I'll just say that.
Absolutely.
One of my favorite songs from them, Anytime, is the next one on side two, Marcus. It's a cover of an old blues man named John Brim.
Summertime is here, need something to keep you cool. Now summertime is here, need something to keep you cool. Hey, little girl, I've got something for you. I'm your ice cream man, stop me when I'm passing by. I'm your ice cream man, stop me when I'm passing by. Now I cool your blue girl, the candy I satisfied.
But nobody really heard much of him. You can find his version on YouTube. But every time, Marcus, when the weather starts to get a little bit extra hot and you hear the bells clang, clang, clanging down the street, you know you need to see the Ice Cream Man.
I'm your ice cream man. Stop me when I'm passing by. I'm your ice cream man. Stop me when I'm passing by. They say all my flavors are here to satisfy.
What a great tune, and what a fun summer song. This is one of those spring summer songs that never, ever gets old, and it doesn't even age out. That Ice Cream Man is still as relevant today as it was when it was written decades ago.
And humana, humana.
Covered by Van Halen decades ago.
The album and side two close with On Fire.
This is a great song that doesn't get enough credit for its greatness, because of all the other fantastic fucking tunes on the record.
I think that's it, right there in a nutshell. The few songs on this that aren't that familiar to people, well, those who haven't listened to the album tirelessly through the years, like you and me, but there's a couple songs in there that even we go, oh yeah, I remember that one now. You remember the tune a little bit, and then all of a sudden the lyrics start to come back, like that night you were out drinking with your buddies and you were in the back seat laughing your ass off, right?
Yep. you start bouncing and moving and you're like, oh yeah. And you start, oh yeah, the lyrics, boom, boom, boom. And by the end of the song, you know all the lyrics again. You're like, oh yeah. One of the articles that I found about in like Ultimate Classic Rock that they had stopped playing this song in like 1984. So that also adds to the mystique of On Fire as well.
Some of that's just the way things have to keep moving as bands move forward. They also went through a singer change in 85, 86, and that's still got nothing to do with what we're discussing back in good old 1978, man.
Speaking of the singer change in 1985, I was reading an excerpt from a Ted Templeman interview that appeared in Greg Renoff's book, and he said that when he first saw Van Halen, even though he ended up going with David Lee Roth, he had initially thought about recruiting Sammy Hagar from Montrose because he thought that he might be good because he wasn't 100% sold on David Lee Roth at first.
Wow.
And then look at how it comes full circle after David Lee Roth leaves the band in the 80s. But Ted Templeman also said he is so glad that he never reached out to Sammy because Van Halen needed to blow up with David Lee Roth. David Lee Roth, Eddie, Alex, Michael Anthony needed to make these records together.
I agree. They created a sensation that would have been different if they were the band that had that guy from Montrose in it. You know what I'm saying?
And yeah, Sammy Hagar was known as the Red Rocker by the time he joined Van Halen in the 80s because of some of his solo work.
Yeah, I saw him a couple times during those years. Good stuff live. And when he joined VH, I was like, okay, let's wait and see what happens. It ended up being pretty cool, too. But back at the beginning, as they're getting signed, and as we were getting ready to have this discussion, I was talking to you, sending you messages about the Zero demo that I found. A long fucker, by the way, like an hour and a half. It sounds like they got in the studio, played everything they had, and then just went back, took time, and mixed it. And what I realized that came from that, aside from some of the songs that would appear on the first couple albums, they really honed that vocal triad where Dave and Mike and Eddie are singing together to create a singular vocal sound.
And one of the other things that I learned over the years about this album is there were no overdubs. There were no extra guitar tracks recorded in on that Van Halen 1 record. It was just Eddie.
And it also started the trend where Dave would get in the booth and record live with them. Now, they never say that he didn't re-record parts or do other takes, but he liked to be in the booth with the boys playing out there when they were laying it down. So it had that live feel. And, you know, when it comes down to it, man, they really owe a lot to Gene Simmons of Kiss, who financed all that stuff, all those demos that we've been listening to leading up to them getting signed and everything. But, you know, I think Gene realized that for rock to move forward, to last, there had to be new proponents. Who better than Eddie and the boys?
That dude, a game changer in all aspects of the rock and roll game. We wouldn't have had the 80s. We wouldn't have had Winger. We wouldn't have had Skid Row. We wouldn't have had Motley Crue if we didn't have Van Halen and Quiet Riot. There's no way.
It all created forward momentum for things that were loud. And as musically diverse as the palette was, to be honest with you, hard rock and metal-y stuff was like not really kicking it big time by the end of the 70s. But they changed that.
And like you said, they came along at a time when the world was moving away from some of that harder rock sound because of all the alternative artists that were making noise. You had the Sex Pistols, you had the Clash, you had the Stranglers, you had the Jam, you had the Pretenders, you had the Police, Elvis Costello, the Cars. So many bands making noise that weren't of that, you know, that high tooting and falutin' rock and roll that was loud in arena, and, you know, just people, you know, that bigness of arena rock. And then Van Halen releases this album and everybody's like, whoa, yes.
It's really, like you said, whether they were playing for 20 or 20,000, they always played to the big arena feel. That's kind of what gets you there. You start projecting that, and the next thing you know, you're growing into that. You go from opening to headlining bigger and bigger. And what comes down the line, even when Dave's still in the band, is exactly what you're hoping for as a rock band, right?
Absolutely. And they did it. And they did it well. And the world is a luckier place because we got Van Halen. And I feel lucky because I lived a significant portion of my developmental years during the fire years of Van Halen, which was many decades, by the way.
Boy, I'd love to get some time on the air here on the podcast with like Don Landy or Logan Jervis, the engineers, or even the great Uncle Ted Templeman himself. It would be awesome to talk more, even more about this album. That's how much I feel.
I could keep talking about this album, and I would love to hear stories from the people who were involved in the process, because it would just make it much more alive than it already is.
Well, as always, your input expands the conversation, so feel free to send us an email to imbalancehistory@gmail.com or add to our posts about this episode on Facebook and X or Twitter. I think we should just call it Twitter. Fuck that guy.
I am Twitter X or whatever, just like
Twitter X. Twitter like Racer X.
Like Racer, yeah, like Racer X and Speed Racer. Twitter X. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, we're on those two and a couple other places that I never go to, but never TikTok. Oh, no. You know, I hear that more and more that TikTok is being marketed to people who are like north of 50. I don't know, man. Not me.
That's because the people under 50 have found something else.
Uh-oh.
Kind of like how Facebook migrated to the older demo.
I remember when the TikTok was new.
After MySpace.
After MySpace. Well, whichever way you choose to reach out to us, please do. You can find us wherever podcasts are distributed. A product of Dark Duck Media on the Pantheon Podcast Network. This has been Game Changers, the debut from Van Halen on the imbalanced history
of rock and roll.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.